Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. It's about 30 years since I was last in Chicago. I was here as an Anglican doing doctoral research, and I've returned. I've come here with some colleagues from the Catholic Herald who also make up a YouTube channel we share together called Catholic Unscripted. We've come to look at Catholic education so that we can get a better understanding of what the issues are in the United Kingdom and what a future might hold, what Catholics here have to teach us about their successes and their struggles. I've seen some wonderful Catholic churches. I've met some very impressive Catholic priests, and none more so than Father Ryan Brady. He grew up on the south side of Chicago, and he began at seminary, spent a few years there, and then withdrew. He worked in development at Catholic Charities in the Archdiocese, and after 14 years, in his 30s, he returned to the seminary at Mundelein and was ordained to the priesthood in May 2021. I hope you won't mind my saying so. I won't be the first person to make the observation, but he really does look like a gangster in a dog collar. And he brings a certain charisma and persona to the work of a downtown Chicago priest, but one with a great deal of experience of the church here, somebody who's withdrawn from training and returned to it and has his finger on the pulse of some of the really important issues in the Archdiocese. He sees the central issue as one of holiness, and that may be because of his connections with Opus Dei. So I turned to Father Ryan to ask him to help me understand the paradoxes, the contradictions, the strengths and the weaknesses of this extraordinarily Catholic community, and to try and make sense of the challenges that secular and Catholic society faces here in the United States. He thinks, not surprisingly, it has a good deal to do with holiness, and he joins me now. Father Ryan, we've just come back from a rather nice lunchtime meal at your favourite Italian restaurant. Thank you for organising it. It was so Chicago. Just felt like an episode out of the 1930s. How long have you been in the Archdiocese of Chicago?
So I was born and raised here on the southwest side of Chicago. I entered seminary at 17 years old. I left at 20. I was in college seminary. And I came back to seminary. I was 34 years old. So I've been in Chicago my whole life. The home I love. It's the place I love. And really, it's the place I'm privileged to serve as a priest.
And you're a member of Opus Dei.
Well, I'm a diocesan priest. I'm assigned and what have you by the Archdiocese of Chicago. And then I'm a member of what's called the Priestly Society of the Holy Cross, which is like a diocesan priest affiliation to Opus Dei. So what that means is I have a spiritual director who helps guide me in a spirituality and a prayerful considering of where do I grow holy in the most ordinary means in my everyday life. I entrust my obedience to the Bishop of Chicago and to my people who I'm called to serve. And then my heart is really nurtured through the spirituality of the work and the great example of St. Jose Maria.
Chicago is supposed to be ungovernable politically in terms of criminal law. Is it ungovernable ecclesiastically?
Well, Cardinal Bernardine said so. And before Cardinal George became Cardinal George, he was a bishop way out west, but he was from Chicago. And Cardinal George, then just Bishop George, was having a conversation with the then ordinary of Chicago, Joseph Bernardine. And Cardinal Bernardine said, look, your hometown is ungovernable. I think Cardinal George, after a number of years, agreed with him and mentioned that it was. I haven't asked Cardinal Supich about it, but, you know, a diocese of this size, with such a broad and diverse group of people, demographics, whether it's ethnically, financially, it's just so huge that I think it is difficult to govern. Ungovernable, I don't know, but certainly difficult. Every diocese has its challenges, but seemingly the bigger the diocese, the bigger the challenges.
I'm just about to read a biography of Cardinal George. I first came across him with his notorious, famous prophetic quote that he would die in his bed, but his successors would chart the most extraordinary map of persecution, imprisonment, martyrdom, and then the restitution of Christendom. Not everyone's heard that quote. Why did he say it? What do you think about it? His timeline may not be right, but is the trajectory right?
It's a funny quote. He said it in a private conversation with priests, and it became public, and he'd always roll his eyes and say, oh, gosh, that quote, because it followed him along, mm-hmm. because people were fascinated by it. And I think people should be fascinated by it, because he's really touching on the history of our church. The church has run through these cycles before, and I think that he was encouraging us in a church where the future does not look always the brightest, to know that even in persecution, even in the face of imprisonment, even in the face of death in the public square, Christ still remains Christ. The victory is his, and we will find ourselves once again as a society, as a world, redirected to Christ and moving forward on our path to holiness. So I think that he's right. I don't know if it was meant to be a direct interpretation. His successor probably will not die in prison. His successor may not die in a public square. But you know, with the example of Cardinal Pell halfway across the world, that quote was looking all the more realistic.
Do you know, I haven't made that connection. I mean, all I was thinking of was that Cardinal Supich may be able to sleep more soundly at night than the literal application of the quote involved. But of course, I mean, you're quite right. Or given what happened to Pell so swiftly afterwards, it fits in at least to the prophetic trajectory, doesn't it? That's extraordinary.
It does. And actually, that line was quoted at Cardinal Pell's funeral at the very end, just before His Eminence was carried out of the cathedral for the last time. The current archbishop, his successor, had mentioned that quote and almost chuckled about, well, what will happen to me? there's a lot of truth to the difficulty the church faces itself in. And there's a lot of truth to the hostility that the society has for the church. But we're not in uncharted waters. We have the saints who have gone before us to look at these examples. How do we grow in holiness in this persecution? How do we grow holiness in a society that wants to imprison us? Or how do we grow holy in a society that wants to eliminate us? We can.
We're not in uncharted waters, but I'm still quite taken aback by the prescience of Cardinal George, because the decadence and the corruption that he his works were prescient of, I think it's obvious in the last 10, 15 years perhaps, but to see it before that and to apply it to Chicago of all places, I mean, looking back, Chicago has its own very distinctive history. But he was, of course, talking of Chicago as part of the Western Church and the American Church, and to have that prescience of social, political, psychological, spiritual corruption now seems to me to be extraordinarily astute. Do you think he was acting? I mean, obviously he was acting as a prophet. Do you think he knew it?
I think so. Cardinal George was always the smartest person in the room wherever he went. And he was able to see things not only based off of that intellect, but also the great love that he had for Christ, the great life of prayer that he had. He was united to the cross in a very unique way. He lived every single day in extraordinary pain, and that brought him closer to Christ, not only with his mind, but with his heart and with his sufferings. And I think that he was gifted some insight into, you know, prophetically warning us as to what we have to face in the future. We just celebrated the anniversary of his death. He died on April 17th, 2015, and it's been 8 years. And the world has changed dramatically in 8 years. And I would have loved to have seen him not necessarily do battle with society, but just question it and say, why do you believe this? Where do you come to believe this from? What do you think is the future of society with your beliefs? People accused him of being a culture warrior. And he would bristle at that and say, I'm not a culture warrior. I've always stood with Christ. For 2,000 years, we have stood at the foot of the cross. We haven't changed. The culture has. I'm not doing battle. You are. I'm just standing for the truth. I think we need those voices. I would have loved to have heard his voice, but I do know that there are others, Cardinal Pell, like we mentioned, who do stand proudly with Christ and stubbornly, maybe, with Christ to keep Christ ever present in the public square. We've spoken a number of times at lunch and over the past day or so about hostility to Christ in the public square. And it leaves people brittle and empty. And I think that the example of Cardinal George, his wisdom, but his love for the Christ, And then there's others out there too. Their wisdom and their love for Christ, it will change the culture. These examples, they do change the culture. They do warm people's hearts to Christ. If we're truly made in the image and likeness of God, we're drawn to him. People are trying to find Christ elsewhere. But through perseverance, through holy stubbornness, we will be an example to others to how to love Christ and how to be loved by Christ, which is what we need. That's why so often we find people angry or empty or searching for peace and happiness everywhere, but where they can really find it. So we have those great examples. Cardinal George is an example, a wonderful one, contemporary. But throughout history are those great examples. John Fisher, Thomas More, obviously very familiar to you. But even further back, since Christ wandered the hills and the valleys of Palestine, there have been those wonderful examples that have drawn us closer and closer to that wonderful God and King of ours, Jesus Christ.
As I look back to the example of some of the people who've inspired us, we could both wax lyrical about Thomas More. There isn't a sense in the voices of the church of people striving for holiness that they wanted relevance. What they wanted was to make Christ accessible. Ever since the Second Vatican Council, and this is not lobbing you a ball over the net to condemn the Vatican Second Council, but in our lifetimes, there's been since then, there's been a constant cry for the church to be relevant to people, which I think is probably based on a misconception of the idea of progress, the notion that perhaps culture is progressing and therefore we have to catch up with it in order to allow people across. Accessibility is something else, but you've talked unusually in terms of holiness. So if we keep holiness and accessibility as two twin strategies for the church in relationship to culture, why has the church for the last 30, 40, 50 years wanted to talk so much about relevance in the public square? Because it's precisely this business of relevance that has this notion of relevance has undermined holiness, undermined the priority of holiness and accessibility. Why is that what we're dealing with theologically as a pastoral aim?
I wonder if people think that holiness is unattainable, or if people think that it's unrealistic, unnatural, and therefore let's water down what our expectations are. There was an American politician who once referred to the soft bigotry of low expectations. and he was talking about it in a racial context. But I wonder if we have that also in a spiritual context. Is there a bigotry out there saying, well, we can't achieve holiness, so let's lower the degree of what's really good so people feel better? I think that the greatest of saints, they became holy not through big, grand, sweeping gestures, but in ordinary faithfulness. Being holy is done in a very normal way. It can be. I'm not sure if you're familiar with a priest by the name of Father Willie Doyle. He was a World War I chaplain in the British Army. He was an Irishman. And he wrote this actually on April 19th. I don't remember the year, but it was sent to me this morning. I think it's really relevant to what we're speaking about. He said, if I were put in a dungeon like the martyrs with nothing to lie on but the bare stone floor, with no protection from intense cold, bread and water once a day for food and no home comfort whatever, I could endure all that for years and gladly for the love of Jesus. Yet, I'm unwilling to suffer a little inconvenience now. I must have every comfort, warm clothes, fire, food as agreeable as I can possibly have, etc. And I think that might be the crux of our problem. We don't see that growth is made in the little ways of even little discomforts offered for Christ. What we have in the midst of us right now, in the most ordinariness of our everyday, can be our path to holiness. Not only can be, should be. You know, there was that time in the church where there was a theory that only priests and nuns could be saints, right? Or saints were just those stuffy, stale, dust-covered images in the church, but they're not. They were alive. They had a pulse. They had a sense of humor. They had charm. Some of them had a little irascibility. But no matter who they were, what they were, where they were at, what time they were in, they had a call to holiness. And For every one of us, there is a hero that we can look to emulate, to grow in holiness. And I don't think we look to them anymore. Our heroes in our modern society are backwards, they're upside down. They're not the ones that we should have, because we look for heaven and earthly things instead of looking throughout earth and seeing glimpses of heaven, which I think the Lord wants to give us. Glimpses of heaven so that we can stay hungry for more. You know, if we're going to be greedy for anything in this world, let's be greedy for encounters with Christ at Sunday Mass in adoration. Let's be greedy for moments, intimate moments spent with his mother and ours while praying the rosary. You know, these things I think have just been thrown out with the bathwater, right? The baby with the bathwater is we don't know how to have a relationship in the most ordinary means with our Lord. And we try to find things to place in that vacuum. We're never going to find Christ in the things of this world. We have to look to him above.
I'm not blaming any previous guests on this podcast, but the number of people who've talked about her has been few and far between. The one I most remember best was also a member of Opus Dei. For me, my heroes have been Becket and Thomas More ever since childhood, but that's partly because I went to a cathedral school where I found myself entranced with the place of Becket's death and spent occasional periods in my 5 years there as an adolescent talking to him. In your own journey, you went to seminary and you withdrew. That's unusual. You went back. That's even more unusual. What happened between those two periods of exit and entry that brought you back as somebody with a focus on holiness?
I entered seminary at 17. I was very young. I was in college, undergraduate, and I left at 20. And I re-entered seminary at 34. I was ordained at 33, I should say, and I was ordained at 37. And in between there, I led a very joyful, happy, pleasant life. I also led a very difficult and troubled life in between, trying to find out who I am and what God longs for me. When I left college seminary, Cardinal George saw me at a funeral and called me aside and said, "I need you to come and see me." I was terrified. Here I'm some kid who just left the seminary, and the Archbishop of Chicago called me and summoned me to his office. Well, I went into the office, he asked me, "Well, what are you going to do? How are you going to continue to study without the seminary support around you? What will you do to pray without the seminary's orarium day in and day out? How do you maintain your relationship with Christ?" And before I knew it, we were an hour and a half into that meeting of him consistently peppering me with questions concerned about my care and my well-being. He's my hero because of his love for me as a father and as a bishop. You know, that's fantastic. And that love carried on. And it helped plant seeds in my mind about what the priesthood really is. And I lost that for a while. I mentioned to you privately, and I speak about it publicly, I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I've been sober for 9 years. And to be honest, as I look back, I realize that my addiction and then the tendencies that come with a person who suffers from addiction, they really had their hands wrapped around me even at 20 years old, even younger than that. I got sober at 30. I learned how to relive my life without that abundance of alcohol and without the fear that comes with living without the abundance of alcohol by doing little things, ordinary things. I met with a group of men who taught me how to relive my life by doing little ordinary things. And my life is completely and fundamentally different from what it was 9 years ago. And I don't remember doing anything. They guided me along the way, and I just, sure, yeah, I'll do that. Come here, sure, yeah, I'll be there. Do this, yeah, sure, I'll do that. I didn't do anything extraordinary. They encouraged me and guided me along the way, and great leaps and bounds were made, but I feel like I didn't put any effort into it. And I think that's what's really drawn me into that holiness of the ordinary. That's what I see in my vocation, not only to the priesthood, but in my vocation to Opus Dei is, sure, you can make these big, broad, sweeping gestures of love for Christ in the public square, but can you pray the Angelus every day at noon? That little thing, it goes a long way in helping me grow in holiness and rebuilding my life, refocusing my life, everything upon Christ, right? I'm really grateful for my addiction, to be honest with you. Now, I hurt a lot of people. I've amended a lot of those relationships. I've mended them. But you know what? I have the great privilege to live two lives in one lifetime. I have the great privilege to live the resurrection in this world and see what death was like, stare it in the eye, and live free from it. And just an ordinary growth has allowed me to do that. And I think that really reflects on gratitude. I try to stay very grateful. I don't deserve to be a priest. I'm not entitled to it. Every day was grateful. I would walk around Mundelein Seminary, which is gorgeous. And every single day, something would strike me. The light would hit a tree or the snow would be falling. And I'd look around and say, my God, you brought me here. And I would remember where if there was only justice in this world, where I belong. And that would be Holy Sepulchre Cemetery or worse. Because for an addict, there's scarier things than dying. And it's keep on living the way that you're living. But God has given me a gift, the gift of sobriety, but also the gift of being able to help other people see hope. And not just people with addiction, but all Christians need to see hope. And we see that big, beautiful flame rising from the Easter candle in this season. That's where our hope is. Christ is our light. Christ guides us forward. As Christians, we should never and can never despair. Because when we do, we push Christ out. So in the midst of all of the troubles in society, I know it's not very well in England. I know it's not very well in Europe. It sure as heck isn't well in the United States. We have something to hope for. We always have something to hope for. And that goes back to that real beautiful prophecy of Cardinal George is, well, eventually there'll be a successor who picks up the shards of a broken society and moves forward with hope in Christ Jesus.
That's very good. I think I'd misinterpreted the end result as not an over-bombastic confidence in Christendom, because I believe in Christendom too. But I think I'd probably misunderstood it as a claim to the ownership of all things good in terms of civilization and culture, which I'm not sure is wrong. It's just, it depends on how you articulate it. But you've expressed it in a different way. You're saying that there is, I guess it's part of the Augustinian, you've made us for yourselves in the heart of restless till they're in you. As we begin to come to him, order, beauty, transcendence, become the stuff of our culture. I'd like to take you back to this hope and talk about it institutionally. I've really been blown away by Catholicism in Chicago. I am so embarrassed at my ignorance. I've been here once before, about 25, 30 years ago, when I was a doctoral student doing some research. I had no idea then. I wasn't a Catholic, so I didn't look in Catholic places. I had no idea about the beauty and the muscular vigor of Catholic Chicago, the churches, the communities, the sacramental life. I've been really blown away as I've been taken around. Yes, some beautiful places, but I'm also aware, talking as we talk to people in schools and education, that you as a society are suffering this dreadful evacuation of youth. By youth, I mean anyone under 30, from the sacrament, from the church. So the numbers aren't in free fall, but the direction is bad. It's bad in the same way it's bad in Europe. And I've been thinking and praying about the church, and I've just been struck by the vigor and the potency of the inheritance, people who made Chicago a Catholic city, the consequences of the decadence, the consequences that this toxic, spiritually vacuous culture that we are living through has had on the church as an institution. So we have Cardinal George and we have Pope Benedict both saying really quite similar things, not being surprised about the diminution, the stripping down, the purgation of the church as an institution, telling us not to be surprised and to hope. But you're going to be living through this in terms of the decades that God gives you as a priest. How do you see both the challenge of the inheritance and the task in hand?
So there's quite a challenge, that's for sure. Chicago, we're sitting right next to a big, beautiful church that was built a century ago in the time of Cardinal Mundelein, who was the first Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. He came here in the 19-teens and he stayed to 1939 when he died, actually at a young age. He left a huge imprint on the city of Chicago, but also the church in America, where there was a robustness. We're going to build big, beautiful churches in the neighborhoods, and you're going to know that we're Catholic. You're going to know that we stand firmly with Christ. We were at a big, beautiful church yesterday, St. Mary the Angels, gorgeous church. They had a bowling alley down in the basement. They had a bar in there. They had a credit union. Everything that they would have dances and dinner dances, everything that you would need for your social life and for your professional life or whatever, you can go to the church for that. Well, that's clearly not the case now. So what do we do with all of these structures? What do we do with that history? It's very hard. You see big empty churches on street corners. The parish my grandparents were married in, it's Our Lady of Peace at 79th and Jeffrey. It's gorgeous, but it's locked. We don't know when it'll ever open again. And it's in a very poor and violent community. People drive past and they see this big, empty, locked church, and they see that someone else has left them. Christ is our hope. He should be, at least, when we see him and when we look to him. You mentioned the decadence of society. It's poison to us. It's a bitter pill that we're given a false sense of hope in secular solutions to a heavenly problem. I think when we don't necessarily need to return to that big, robust, muscular, brick-and-mortar type Christianity, but let's nurture our hearts at least a little bit and begin to start there. And when we begin to start there, we can become strong, secure, holy, what we're called to do. In the Easter season, we read through the Acts of the Apostles and look how they started, and then look how they finished. We can finish that way. As hard as it may be, I have faith. I have hope. We had a meeting with our current Archbishop Cardinal Supich, the newly ordained priest, the other day, and he encouraged us to promote vocations. Find the good, holy young men in your parishes. Encourage a vocation to the priesthood in them. I look around, and we have a small amount of men being ordained this year, but all of them are good men, and they're holy. We have a number of young, vibrant, religious community of women in the States. One right here in Chicago, they're doing great. I have so much hope that who remains and what remains is strong, and it will rebuild. You know, the trimming of the rosebush analogy. You trim the rosebush so that it grows strong. And then Joseph, Father Joseph Ratzinger, was getting at in that beautiful prophecy that gets oft quoted. I think it's in Ignatius Press, Faith in the Future. It's the very last chapter. It's such a great, great thing for me to read as a young priest, to know that we're okay. We're okay. Not as okay as we'd like to be. We should be hungry. We should be greedy for souls. If there are 1,000 souls out there that don't know Jesus Christ, I can't be content with converting even 999 of them. I have to be content only with 100 of those souls in my stead to go to heaven. And I think that type of holy hunger is not only necessary for the church going forward, but I see it in the young religious women. I see it in the young priests. I see it in the very vibrant young people and young families that are coming to Mass. I live in a very good community of people. We have 370 children in our Catholic school. And I tell you, in the past 2 years, I've seen more and more young families come into Mass. And when we preach the truth of who Christ is, when we celebrate the Mass with a reverence to what takes place, when we pay attention to the beauty of Christ's presence in the Mass, when we have Eucharistic adoration, when we pray for vocations, the church thrives. And we see it in certain places, we see it in certain parishes, and then we see it in certain hearts. The church will thrive again. I know it. I'm convinced of it. If there was only justice, I wouldn't be here. There's mercy. So there's mercy not only for myself, there's mercy for the church, there's mercy for each and every individual. God's love, he's never going to be outdone in offering that love generously. And I know that the Lord wants us to thrive, and I know the Lord wants those 1,000 souls that are entrusted to me and more. So yes, I have hope. It will be easy, don't get me wrong. I'll go to bed very tired every night, but it's a rewarding tired. To know that you've done Christ's work.
I'm going to move from the joy of that optimism, theological optimism, to be indelicate, mm-hmm. and say that the Archdiocese of Chicago has taken some pretty bad hits with the financial reparations for sexual misconduct. Mm-hmm. The sociologists tell us that there have been two waves of decadent homosexual prejudices into the priesthood in the last 70 years. We seem to be poised in a problematic conversation with the progressives who are trying to, irrespective of the damage of that incontinent sexuality has created the last 70 years, were poised to try and take us down the road of continual unbounded incontinence. Where's the hope? Where's the muscle? Where's the strategy for Orthodox Catholicism to confront this latest and most dangerous threat to holiness?
Sure. So I don't think any church is perfect because they're made up of people. I don't think any seminary is perfect because they're made up of people, or parish because they're made up of people, and we're all fallen people. But what we do is we vigilantly protect our people. We vigilantly protect ourselves. When I was in Mundelein, before I went to the seminary, I had to take a very, very long and very, very thorough series of examinations all day long. And then we had to go back for a follow-up. We had a number of continuing follow-ups, and we had a psychologist who was on staff at Mundelein. I was really confident in the men that were there. But not only that, I was also very confident in the way in which the seminary handled the spiritual fatherhood aspect of priesthood, very prayerfully discerning and very prayerfully embracing celibacy and chastity. Now, like I said, no program is perfect. There are men who are manipulators and may manipulate their way through the system. But what we have to do is really lead the way as a church to protect people. And I think starting in 1992, I believe, in the Archdiocese of Chicago, 1996, around that era, Chicago began to do things in the diocese to prevent sexual abuse of children, to remove priests who have been accused, to protect not only young people, but the church, the innocence of the youth, the dignity and the sanctity of the church. And actually, the Archdiocese of Chicago pretty much led the way into the Dallas Charter, which took place in 2002, which were large, wide-sweeping measures taken by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Now, that too wasn't perfect. It's been worked on and amended and what have you. But I think if we remain vigilant to continue to do the best that we can to protect our people, but not only that, to protect the innocent who may be falsely accused, to protect the dignity and good name of people, while protecting the dignity and the innocence of a child. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. Now, that type of sexual deviancy of manipulating and abusing children, it comes from the evil one, and there's no denying that. And we have to stay vigilant to pray that the evil one stays at bay and out of our church, out of our seminaries, out of our rectories. You know, with that being said, again, I at least from my experience at Mundelein, they did a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of good work, and they sent us away. We did a program called the Institute of Priestly Formation, which really helped us maturely look at our own sexuality and what wounds do we have and how do we grow in our understanding of a very healthy celibacy so that we're not using, you know, pornography, or we're not using, you know, improper relationships or any of those things that are just unhealthy for ourselves and for the church as a crutch. Now we have to continue that progress. You know, if you study in 4 to 6 years, 8 years in the seminary, and that's the last time you begin to think, work, or pray on your life of celibacy, we're in trouble as a church because the individual priest is in trouble. Priests need to maintain good and healthy relationships with each other, to grow as one, to be honest with each other when they need help. The problem is the problem, and the solution isn't merely done on a bishop's conference level. It needs to be done with one priest taking care of another. And then the parishioners seeing a problem and maybe, you know, saying, look, Father, do you need help? We have to love one another as Christians. And when we love one another, we see things that need to be fixed. And not every man who feels he's called to be a priest is called to be a priest or has the proper skills, faculties, or mindset to do it. And I think the seminary system in the United States, at least, is doing a much better job than it had in the past of screening out those who shouldn't be here, not only before they begin, but also throughout. But as is always the case, there's so much work to be done. Even one of the 12 who followed Christ for 3 years intimately fell.
18% failure rate in amongst the apostles.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm going to finish by asking you a question framed in a way I hope you can answer. Instead of asking you what qualities the new Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago ought to have in your view, I'm going to ask you instead about what you think about the replacement to our Holy Father in Rome. When we pray for the Pope Francis daily, when the time comes for a conclave to elect a successor, what would you be looking for? What would you want the cardinals to provide you with in terms of a new holder of the papal office to take the church from where it is now to where you would hope it might get to?
So there was a bishop somewhere, and I can't remember who it was, where it happened, but he was named the bishop, and he stands up in front of the media, and they have the big announcement and the Q&A, and Bishop, what is your pastoral plan going forward? What is your 5-point plan? If you have 3 priorities going forward, what are they? And they would ask all these questions. And he said, the bishop's agenda is to become a saint so that his people can become saints with him. And my plan is to follow the gospel. Who are my greatest consulters? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I hope for kindness. I hope for holiness. I hope for a very paternal figure who loves. In my youth, I was 21, I think, when John Paul II had died. He looked a little like my grandfather. Maybe that's why I was so fond of him. But he also he loved me as a young person. I was in his presence once, and it was in 2003. I was on a pilgrimage, and I was in Paul VI auditorium with thousands of people. And when he came out, he was very sick. He was hunched over. He was being wheeled in a chair. And I felt drawn to him. And I also felt like I was the only person in the room. I think that's the kind of quality we need, that type of very attractive holiness, that type of attractive kindness, that type of attractive, you know, fatherly love. Yeah, and that's what I look forward to, you know, not only in the Holy Father or, you know, as my own bishop or archbishop, but also in the pastor of my parish, and also in the fathers and mothers of our families, a real robust love and desire to become a saint, I think across the board is something that I hope for and long for just about everybody. And I know that, you know, if the Holy Father, if the bishop of a diocese, if the pastor of a parish longs to be a saint, celebrates the Mass as a priest who wants to be the saint, who ministers to his people in his office or in the people's living room as a person who wants to be a saint, we're going to be in good shape. We won't have to worry about a lot of the problems that we're trying to tackle right now, because I think holiness will solve them for us.
Paul Ryan, it's been great to spend this time with you. Thank you for the conversation. God bless you in Chicago.
My pleasure. God bless you.